Hello, welcome to this week's Therapy for Me. And after the excitement of last week, where we tried to, or I tried to take a couple of ideas and see if I could make some form of kind of narrative that kind of made a little bit of sense, I'm back to the normal this week of five different things that have struck me that I'm just going to rabbit on about. But not until we've had a little bit of that twangy guitar.
Monday.
As Josh and I were walking through Sheffield on Saturday, we were in town for the football, we were approached by and passed by a march, a congregation of people who'd met at the town hall and were walking down to the football ground en masse in celebration of the life of Harvey Wilcox, who was a 15-year-old lad who had been stabbed at school, fatally stabbed at school a few days earlier. And it was a remarkably poignant thing to witness as a real throng of friends of Harvey and Sheffield United supporters collected together to offer each other support in what had been a very difficult week around the city on the back of such tragic news. Now, at the 15th minute in the game, there was a minute's applause, and the referee stopped the match, which is unusual. There's often, you often get applause at football matches at different points in time. Normally, if somebody who maybe works at the club or a fan or somebody in the community has passed away, there'll often be something that goes on, and a face will be put on the screen, and there'll be something in recognition of the event. And it happens whilst the game's in play. And this is probably the first time I've ever known a game be stopped by the referee and all the players and all the coaches and everybody connected with the running of the game, the officiating and running the game, join in for that minute's applause. Such is the shock that's gone through the city in terms of this event and what it actually means. And I understand that a similar thing went on at Sheffield Wednesday's away game. The lad was a United supporter, but at the end of the day, he was a football supporter, and that is something that you'd expect, joins the city. The friendly banter aside, those things are deeply felt on both the red and the blue side of the city when they happened, or when things like that happened. So I just wanted to put it out there, to say thank you to everybody who took part, everybody who got involved, everybody who organised it. But also that act where you stop a football match for something that is far more important than what's going on the pitch.
Tuesday.
I was fortunate enough to see Jason Isbell play a solo show at the Barbican in London on Monday, last night, as far as the podcast is concerned, but on Monday. And it was truly amazing, as you'd expect it to be. He is a rare talent. He held a theatre transfixed with just him and a guitar. And you do that when you are an exceptional musician, an exceptional wordsmith, and an exceptional songwriter, which is what he is. And I know I keep banging on about Jason Isbell, and I apologise for that, but he just is that rare thing that is something very, very special. And the way he conducted himself, the performance, he is transcending into that space of where, true creative talents occupy. But I don't want to carry on banging on about how good he was, because if you know, and if it's not your cup of tea, then that's fine. It's the first time I've ever been to the Barbican, and I didn't really know what the Barbican was. I didn't even know where it was. Let's start with that. I assumed the Barbican was somewhere on the South Bank. I don't know why, but I just did. That's where I thought it was. And I thought it was something that looked a little bit like the Festival Hall of the National Theatre, which, to be fair, the Barbican Centre kind of does. But the Barbican Centre is in the middle of this brutalist housing development from the sort of mid-60s, which is like nothing I've kind of seen before. And as somebody who's grown up in around Sheffield and is used to sort of things like the Park Hill Flats and what have you, I'm used to kind of 60s, 70s, you know, brutalist architecture, but not on the sheer scale of the Barbican, which is massive, absolutely massive, and, you know, has a dystopian feel about it. But I have to say, I really, really liked it. And they have owned the brutalist, you know, moniker. And if you go in the shop in the Barbican Centre itself, everything is, there's a fantastic, you know, sort of logo using the letters that make up brutal, adorning the kind of things you'd expect it to be adorning, like tote bags and mugs and this, that and the other, you know, notebooks and what have you. But it's really, really clever what they've done and how they've embraced and taken ownership of that. And it's the kind of thing that I didn't expect I would like, but I really, really do. I really, really, really do. And it was only then that I started doing a bit of reading into the place. And basically, it's just up from the city, or down from the city. It's in that general locale, sort of up from St. Paul's. And I can't believe I've never actually strayed there and seen it. But just because of its sheer size, I can't believe I've never strayed in there and seen it. But what I was amazed by when I did a little bit of research, and I am now minded to do some more, and maybe, you know, find a book or whatever, or a couple of books, and actually do some reading about the place. But it wasn't built as a council thing. It was built as homes for upper middle class. You know, folks working in the city. It was a very aspirational place to be. And there's a lot of famous people who've lived there, you know, not least the likes of George Best. And that was the market it was going after. So this wasn't one of those 70s experiments where you get a tower block with a lot of land around the base and you kind of look at kind of the way people are hemmed into a tower, but also think, well, I kind of get the idea because there was all this space around the bottom and it probably felt like something space age and yada, yada, yada. But in reality, it's cardboard boxes reaching up to the sky. This was meant to be a plush luxury place. And actually, when you look at the kind of people who are probably still, I mean, it's got a real creative, artistic kind of vibe running through it, which was absolutely, absolutely tremendous. And the other thing was, I'd met somebody and had a coffee in the festival hall earlier in the day. And I've often met people down at the National Theatre as well. And, you know, both of those are fairly brutalist kind of buildings. But what is really nice when you get, and I don't know if this is something specific to theatres, and I don't know if it's something specific to theatres in London, but what I love is how people inhabit the space. And it was exactly the same with the Barbican Centre, which was there's restaurants there. There were people eating. There were people just with laptops. There are people that had just gone there to work or just to hang out. There was a real kind of sense of being in a special place, even though it was a theatre foyer. That's the same when you hang out at the Festival Hall or when you hang out, you know, at the National Theatre or even at the British Library. And maybe it's a London thing. I don't know, but there's just something nice about the vibe and the feeling of being in those places, even though essentially you're talking about big, you know, places made up of big concrete blocks and things that look like egg boxes.
Wednesday.
I've become a little bit addicted to the drip, and I can't believe how different it tastes. I've had one of these coffee things in the cupboard for ages. So I don't know what it looks like really, I don't know how to explain it, but basically it's the thing that you put the coffee paper in and you put some coffee in and you pour some water in the top and it drips directly into a mug, okay? Or into a, you know, you could do it into a bigger pot and pour more coffee in and keep topping the water up to make more coffee. But essentially, you know, the way I'm using it is I put this thing which is like a funnel, effectively, on top of the mug. Shove a coffee, a coffee paper in, put some coffee in there, and just fill it with hot water, let it drip through. And hey presto, a very quick way of making coffee. And I appreciate the fact that you probably, there's a bit of an issue with the environment in terms of the papers. I get that, and I need to start getting better at recycling my coffee grinds anyway. So that's all up for debate. And I know the paper's recyclable, but anyway, just for a second, can you forgive me that, in terms of whether that is better or worse for the planet than what I was doing previously, which is using a cafetiere? And just let me say that I can't believe the difference in taste. I can't believe the same coffee tastes so much different in one of those being effectively made that way round, rather than when you put water in a cafetiere and you leave the coffee grinds in it for, say, 3 or 4 minutes, and then you plunge it down. And I'm sure somebody can explain to me technically why that is. It's probably got something to do with the fact that the water is passing through the coffee far quicker. I kind of had worked that out for myself. But I can't believe the difference in actual taste. Because theoretically, one should just taste like a slightly stronger version than the other. Would that be the way of looking at it? But that's not how it seems to work. It seems to taste totally different. So I'm now somewhat, and more than somewhat, transfixed by what happens with the drip.
Thursday.
I didn't think I'd be doing this, but I'm going to call out and say thank you to Julie Hartley Brewer, of all people, who is somebody that in the past I would have disagreed with passionately on a load of topics. But actually, I'm starting to think now that some of that kind of bluntness and tenacity that's been on the right of politics for a while and has been used quite effectively on a number of topics, Brexit being one of them, is also required to call out some of the nonsense that appears to be coming out and being fawned over, the stuff that's floating out of the US and is being fawned over by people around the globe. And in this case, it was her going hammer and tongs with Richard Tice about Trump's plan to effectively, almost unilaterally, well, it's not unilaterally, is it? It's come to an agreement on ending the Ukraine-Russian war with one side of the argument, and that side being the one that illegally took the territory in the first place. Now, you know, through this process, Reform's been in a difficult position, or has been in a position where they've often suggested that actually Russia was badly done by. I know Farage has done that on a number of occasions. Farage appears to have gone quite quiet on this topic, but Tice has been very animated in jumping on the Trump bandwagon and basically saying it's peace at any price. Which is easy to say when the price that you're talking about is effectively giving away Ukrainian territory. It is appeasement. I don't know how else you sort of look at it in any way other than it is appeasement. And I wonder, I mean, she made the very, very strong argument of, well, what would happen if this was the UK? What would happen if somebody had invaded, you know, Kent or wherever, or Sussex or wherever, and you know, basically the only way to get peace was to cede the land? And obviously it becomes that difficult example when you put it like that, because Tice wasn't in a position or didn't want to admit that that would be an outcome he would look at. And he then made some preposterous attempts at, you know, looking at Ireland as an alternative or as a some form of analogy that made any kind of sense, which it clearly didn't. But the point about it was the vigour and the way she rebutted the nonsense from him, which we need more of that. And if it takes people like that to do it, then we're going to have to form unlikely alliances if we're going to really combat some of what's coming out of the US at the moment, because it clearly is setting the tone for global politics in a way that's truly, truly scary.
Friday.
After last week's epic, I'm not going to keep you for 25 minutes or the best part of 25 minutes again. You're going to get a bit of time back. So we're very close to the end for this week, and you can have a little bit of a breather because you put a decent shift in last week if you got all the way through. Interestingly, I've had quite a lot of people comment on last week's TFM, which was really nice, actually. It certainly did allow me to get some frustration out of the way and try and find a common kind of thread or theme of the way that life appears to be developing through two totally different prisms. What I'm going to leave you with this week is the fact that I sat down to watch half an hour of The Big Short the other day, which if you've never seen, you should see. It's an incredible movie made about the causes for or causes of the financial crash in the US and the subprime mortgage market. And aside from the fact that the performances are exceptional, absolutely exceptional across the board, and it's a really interesting piece of filmmaking, it just sticks with you. And as I say, I sat down. I tend to have a film on the go or something on the go, and I'll often break a film down and watch it in 3 or 4 half-hour chunks. And I sat down to watch The Big Short because I got half an hour. I got a cup of tea. I thought, you know what? I'll watch a bit of this. That'd be quite entertaining. Then I'll get up and do something else and what have you. And I sat transfixed for the near 2.5 hours that the film is in length and just couldn't move, and I'd forgotten how good a film it is. And it truly is an incredible movie. And I don't know what it won in terms of awards. I don't know if individual performances won awards or not. But it is quite exceptional. So I'm going to put out to anybody who hasn't seen The Big Short, you must watch it. It's on Netflix. You just must watch it. And if you have seen it, go and watch it again, because this is something I could see myself watching now in a fairly regular turnaround, because I don't think that story is going to get any less interesting. And I think there's going to be bits I'm going to pick up every single time I watch it. It's a bit like the fact that I've watched JFK probably 4 or 5 times, or I've watched All the President's Men, you know, that number of times. There are certain films you can just stand to rewatch because they are such fascinating pieces of work, and this absolutely fits into that category. So I'm throwing that one out there as my thing for the week. I didn't expect to be doing that. I didn't expect to be talking about it. I didn't expect to have watched it. But I could almost watch it again. You know, I could watch it again now, you know. And do you know what? I saw another one. The Ides of March appeared as being a title that was ending soon, which is obviously Clooney playing a presidential candidate. I think he's a presidential candidate. I can watch that over and over. You know, that really is an exceptional piece of movie making. And you go through this kind of list of things that just have that ability. Have that ability to grab you, and you can just pick something fresh out every single time that you watch them. Anyway, that's it for me. I'm going to leave you with that one. Have a great week. Have a great remainder of your Valentine's Day, if that is your thing, because it's still Friday night. We're going to be settling down to something. We don't tend to do Valentine's. We do cards, but that's about it. So we'll just settle down in a minute and have something to eat and you know, probably watch an episode of something or what have you to while away the evening. But if it's your thing and you're out and you're enjoying it, then have a great time. And if you know what, if it's not your thing and you think it's a made-up thing, then that's all fine too. Anyway, stay safe, take care of yourself, try and find a bit of peace, and I will speak to you soon.
3rd Epiphany, then please subscribe and share as you see fit. This has been an A Short Stories production.